Good day, and welcome to the Drinker, Bill and Reith LLP Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Cody, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. Welcome to our summer edition of Inside the Beltway, brought to you by the Drinker, Bill and Reith Best Interest Compliance Team, with the help of Natixis. I'm the moderator of the program. I have with me the other presenters. And after we're done with the presenters, at the end of the program, hopefully the last 10 or 15 minutes, we'll be able to take your questions. And we do have some pre-submitted questions as well. Also with me on the call are Brad Campbell, who many of you all know already. Brad's a partner in our Washington, D.C. office and the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. Sandy Granum, who heads up the firm's FINRA practice, both on controversy and compliance. Jim Lundy, who was a SEC attorney for over a decade, both in examinations and enforcement. And Jim Dolan, who is the Vice President of Retirement Strategies for Natixis Investment Managers. So that you know, this presentation is being recorded, as we've always done in the past. And within a matter of days, it'll be posted on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com under a tab that's called Insights and Events. It'll take a few days. But even better than that, for everybody who is registered for the program, we'll actually send you out an email with a link letting you know when it's been posted. So if you didn't write down the website, don't worry about it. You'll get it. Before we jump into our update on regulation best interest and other SEC guidance, I want to turn this over to Jim Dolan for a minute just to tell us what's going on with him and Natixis. And also I want to thank Jim for their support in putting on these programs. It would not be possible without Natixis and Jim helping us. So, Jim?
Thanks so much, Fred. I appreciate it. And thank you. It's been a long-standing partnership, and I think it's been really great. So we're happy to continue to do this. As Fred mentioned, my name is Jim Dolan. I work at Natixis Investment Managers. I'm responsible for our strategic relationships and our retirement business. For those of you who might not be familiar with Natixis, we have 20 specialized investment managers globally with just under $1 trillion of assets under management with over 200 investment solutions. And we focus on active thinking to give our clients and their end clients an ability to manage through all market environments. What I'd like to do is just to bring your attention to our focus on sustainability. Natixis has an affiliate, Mirova, which manages the Global Sustainable Equity Fund, as well as the industry's only Sustainable Target Date Suite. We launched that about 2.5 years ago, and it's a really important strategy to me, so I just wanted to share it with this group. And again, I want to thank Drinker Biddle for the partnership, and I want to thank everyone for calling in today and spending some time in the beautiful summer month with us. So, Fred, back to you.
Hey, Jim. Thank you so much. Let's go right to what might be the biggest event of the last 3 months, which is the Securities and Exchange Commission issuing its final regulation best interest, its interpretation of the standard of conduct for investment advisors, its interpretation of the meaning of solely incidental, and the new regulation on Form CRS that will impact every investment advisor and broker-dealer no later than June 30 of next year. So with that introduction, let me turn it over to an SEC attorney and a FINRA attorney to give you the overview for the moment. So Jim and Sandy, jump right in.
Thank you very much, Fred. Hello, everyone. As Fred said, the release of the final Reg BI package, which has the four components that Fred described, is one of the most significant regulatory developments by the SEC and other financial regulators in recent years. And it's incredibly important for all of us in the industry. Now, that said, We will not be able to do it justice in any way whatsoever during our portion of this call, but there will be more to come. We have a best interest compliance team that Fred leads here at the firm. We've already published some alerts on this topic. We have a working group where we're strategizing for how best to deliver real substantive and strategic guidance rather than just the ongoing summaries that do occur on the heels of these types of announcements. And while those are important and educational, we're in the process of developing more strategic tools for folks, and there will be more to come on that. So the purpose of this call, I think, was for Sandy and I to provide an overview and let folks know that there's more on the horizon for us to share with folks who are affected by this. And in some way, shape, or form, it's going to affect just about all of us. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sandy to talk a little bit about Reg BI, and then we'll go back and forth through the various components during our portion of today's call.
Hi. So as Jim said, this is an overwhelming subject. First of all, it's over 1,000 pages of a read, but it's a significant new development in the financial services industry. So this will be, in essence, a nutshell, if you would. On June 5th, 2019, the SEC approved the final Reg B package, and the final Reg B package consisted of a standard of conduct for broker-dealers. It consisted of a form CRS, which really is a client relation summary. It had a standard of conduct for investment advisors, and it had interpretations of the solely incidental principle. Reg BI, although it was only enacted this June, will go into effect on June 30, 2020. That's right, 2020, so 12 months from now. A very aggressive schedule. The SEC has conceded that it's a very aggressive schedule. It also has said that it's making itself available for inquiries so that the implementation can go through smoothly. We have no reason to believe that that implementation will be put off. In its press release, the SEC described this new Reg BI package, as when making a recommendation for a security transaction or an investment strategy involving securities, a broker-dealer must act in the retail customer's best interest and cannot place its own interest ahead of the customer's interest. Regulation best interest in an enhanced form from the proposal applies to account recommendations, including recommendations to roll over or transfer assets in a workplace retirement plan account to an IRA, and recommendations to make plan distributions. It also applies to implicit recommendations to hold that result from agreed upon account monitoring. So to put this in perspective, I'll give you just a brief history. I know we don't have a lot of time, but prior to Dodd-Frank 2010, the securities industry did not recognize a traditional broker-dealer relationship as a fiduciary relationship. In order to be a fiduciary relationship, there had to be some enhanced element to it. You had to rely on the person. You had to have control over the account. But in general, broker-dealers were considered not to be fiduciaries. And that, of course, was distinct from investment advisors who have sworn to be fiduciaries. The problem was that the public couldn't necessarily distinguish between what an investment advisor was versus what a broker was, and Dodd-Frank in 2010 gave the SEC a mandate to determine whether there was, in fact, public confusion. And in January of 2011, the SEC published a study on investment advisor and broker-dealers where it found that, in fact, there was investor confusion, and it undertook to correct that. And for years following that, the SEC, with some marked quotes from Mary Jo White, said, "We are going to apply a uniform standard of fiduciary duty to investment advisors and brokers." But the SEC actually never came up with a uniform standard of conduct for investment advisors and brokers. And they could not agree on what that would be. In the interim, the Obama administration directed the DOL to come up with a fiduciary duty standard for retirement accounts. And so we had the fiduciary duty rule that was enacted in April 2016, and it would have an applicable date of, April 2017. In between those two dates, the administration changed, and although the the fiduciary duty rule actually did become applicable. It was not enforceable. And then ultimately in March of 2018, the Seventh Circuit vacated the fiduciary duty rule. And shortly thereafter, the SEC came out with a proposal in 2018. And that proposal received over 6,000 comment letters. I'm told that 3,000 of those were actually individual, not like bulk mass comment letters. And now we have a final rule that is not substantially different. It is different from the proposal last year, but is not substantially different. So the new rule has four obligations. And the obligations are a disclosure obligation. A broker-dealer has to disclose material facts about the relationship and recommendations, including specific disclosures about the capacity in which the broker is acting, the fees, the type and scope of services provided, conflicts, limitations on service and product, and whether the broker is providing monitoring service. There's a duty of care, and the broker there must exercise reasonable diligence, care, skill when making a recommendation on a retail customer to a retail customer. The broker must understand potential risks, rewards, costs associated with the recommendation, and the broker-dealer must then consider these factors in light of the retail customer's investment profile. Now, this will not sound unfamiliar because it sounds very much like what the present suitability rule is, FINRA Rule 2111. And 2111 was sort of a morphation from the Know Your Customer rule, right? You had to know what their net worth was and what their investment perspective was, what their risk tolerances were, and it took the churning rule and went a little bit further. So you couldn't have investments that were helping the broker but hurting the customer in terms of fees generated, but there had to be an intent component, which I'll get back to in a minute. The third component of these obligations, four obligations, is the conflict of interest obligation, where the broker must establish, maintain, and enforce written policies and procedures reasonably designed to identify at a minimum disclosure or eliminate the conflict of interest. And this obligation is an enhancement from the proposal that existed in 2018. And the last obligation is a compliance obligation, where the broker-dealer must establish and maintain enforcement policies and procedures reasonably designed to achieve compliance with the best interest reg. If you look at the care obligation, which I was talking about earlier, the underlying elements of that is a reasonable basis to say that this security recommendation is suitable and that the recommendation is customer-specific suitable. So it has to be suitable in general, and then it has to be suitable for this particular customer, and then it has a quantitative suitability aspect of it, which is the sort of morphation of the churning concept, which is in the scheme of all the trades for this customer, this additional trade still maintains its suitability aspect. It still is suitable. And under Rule 2111, there has been a quantitative suitability element, but it required that the broker have control over the account. This new Reg BI takes out that element of control. So it moved from churning where there had to be intent, and the 2111 didn't require intent, but did require control. And the new Reg BI requires neither intent nor control, so it's morphed into a more fiduciary-ish type of standard. Although there is pains in the reg to say that it's not a fiduciary standard, it does speak sort of in deference to the fiduciary rules that the DOL had articulated just years before, and does speak in terms of best interest. And it does elevate the 40 Act fiduciary concept, right? Brokers could either be paid by commissions or they could be paid by fees, and if they were paid by fees, they fell under the 40 Act and they had to disclose conflicts. Now they have to disclose and mitigate conflicts, even as a broker. And that's true whether they are a fee-based or commission-based broker. So I feel I've been speaking for a long time, and I think I should probably wrap up. But in a nutshell, that is our new fiduciary, our new best interest rule. And we expect that it will be going forward on June 30th, 2020. Jim?
Thanks, Sandy. And I'll try to move through the RIA guidance and Form CRS to get it turned over to Brad. In terms of the RIA guidance, there was proposed guidance that came out with the proposals in the spring of 2018, and then the final guidance was issued on June 5th as part of the package. I think the SEC's position is there's not anything new here. However, it provided them with an opportunity to clarify, reaffirm, and establish guidance at a commission level for the first time on what this fiduciary duty means. And they break it down into two primary duties, a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. Just want to talk a little bit about the duty of care and a couple interesting things that make up that particular duty as articulated in the final release and as it was articulated in the proposed release. By way of background, as Sandy said, while the standards seem to be converging in a way, they nevertheless are not uniform. The releases were very clear about that, and the SEC chairman has been very clear about that. However, under the duty of care, the first duty within the three duties discussed in that aspect of the guidance is, in fact, a duty to provide advice that is in the quote-unquote best interest of the client. The term best interest is not defined anywhere in the package. However, the best guidance on what constitutes best interest is, of course, in the releases related to the Reg BI rule itself. Again, the commission will be adamant, and I think everyone agrees there is not a uniform standard. However, the convergence does seem to be continuing, with that being the first subcategory of the duty of care as it is articulated in this guidance. The other duty that we are seeing examiners view more aggressively is the duty to monitor. And the duty to monitor for the RIA is being viewed as an active duty. And, for example, retail clients that are in wrap accounts where the activity in that account may not be particularly active, through the duty to monitor, we are seeing examiners require firms to reassess whether it is, in fact, appropriate for that type of client to be in that type of an account. That's just one example. So I think there'll be some scrutiny applied. While this is simply a reaffirmation, perhaps from one perspective, the reality is this is commission-level guidance, and firms should look at it very, very closely and assess the guidance against their policies and procedures and practices. Turning to Form CRS, like Reg BI, this is a new obligation. It has several items, and those items are a summary of relationship and services, the description of the fees, costs, conflicts, and standard of conduct, disclosures regarding disciplinary history, and where to find additional information. For specific RIA and broker-dealer registrants, the requirement is that it be limited to 2 pages. For dual registrants, they can provide 2 two-page Form CRS disclosure documents or a 4-page document. But the concept of layering disclosures is also embedded in the final release, and that indicates that the documents, through links of additional disclosures, ultimately will be larger than the quote-unquote required 2 pages. Another interesting development is that they require that this disclosure document include, under item 5, a reference to the SEC's investor education website, which is interesting that they are going to proactively make this part of the disclosure regime under Form CRS. So, Sandy, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on Form CRS from your background and things you're hearing from your brokerage clients.
You know, it's just it's a 16-page instruction on how to do a 2-page form, so it'll be a challenge.
So with that, why don't we turn it over to Brad and Fred? I know they have a lot to cover. As I said at the start, in 20 minutes, Sandy and I by no means are going to claim that we did justice to the, you know, almost 2,000 pages of discussion of these topics in the final releases. We simply wanted to provide an overview and also let everyone know that we understand the seriousness of these issues and the seriousness with which the industry is taking them, and we will be providing additional guidance in a variety of ways going forward. So thanks, Fred, and back to you.
Yeah, just some general comments on this. My gut level feeling is that for broker-dealers, even though it's not going to be enforced until June 30 of 2020, my feeling is you're already behind schedule. Broker-dealers are already behind schedule. There is so much there that it's going to be really hard to get into compliance. And let me just give you a couple of small examples. Under the regulation best interest, in the final rule, the SEC moved the fact that you had to consider costs of investments and investment strategies every time an investment or investment strategy is recommended to a retail customer every time, they moved that from the release discussion over into the rule. It is now in the rule that that is a factor to be considered. Well, from a broker-dealer perspective, what are your processes for considering cost and the recommendation of a variable annuity and the recommendation of a third-party asset manager and the recommendation of mutual funds? What's the process? What software, what databases, what thinking, what's the process? And then the training and the policies and procedures and the supervision and all the stuff that flows once you've made the decision how you're going to handle the issue. Another one is in the form CRS that Jim was talking about, you have to say whether or not you will monitor the accounts. So if you don't monitor the account, then you have to say, we will not monitor your account. Broker-dealers have not historically monitored accounts formally as a requirement. They may have done that for making recommendations informally, but it was not in the agreement with the customer. Now there's going to have to be a notice of that, and I think some broker-dealers are seriously considering adding monitoring to part of their contractual obligation. What is your decision about that if you're a broker-dealer? Will you be doing that? And then there are rules about how much and when and how to do it. And then, again, there's all the policies and procedures, the training, the supervision, all that stuff that has to flow from that. On the other hand, for RIAs, I think that I still think you have to pay attention and get going by this fall on working on it, because there are issues like my, and from my perspective, the SEC is taking a much broader view of conflicts of interest, or at least they're publicizing that they have a broad view. For example, if you recommend that an investor transfer their IRA to you, if the investor agrees to transfer the IRA to an RIA, the RIA makes more money than if they didn't transfer. Conflict of interest, a recommendation that results in a benefit to the RIA, to the investment advisor. Where is that disclosed to the clients? Is it in the ADV? Is it somewhere else? So, and then another example would be with the form CRS. If the individual advisor is both an IAR of a RIA and a registered rep of a broker-dealer, they have to give both CRSs to the customer. And then under the rules, they have to look at all of the accounts at the broker-dealer, they have to look at the types of accounts at the broker-dealer and the types of accounts at the RIA, both of which supervise them, and they have to recommend the best interest account from one or the other. They can't say, I'm just here as an RIA, and that's the end of it. So how does that get supervised? How do people get trained how to do that? What's the process? There's a lot here, and I think the starting point for dealing with all this is to sit down with your attorney or with another attorney who understands all this stuff and get an hour or two of education on what the issues are, because if you don't know the issues, you can't deal with it. You can't even begin to start work on it. So just emphasizing what Sandy and Jim said, this is huge. I mean, this is very, very big. And I think my general view is that in talking with people, they don't realize how much has to be done and how short 1 year is going to be, considering all the work. Okay, I'll get off my high horse. Let's switch over to some of the recent class action settlements in 401k and 403b plans. And keep in mind, these are settlements. They're not reported decisions. So it's not a court saying, here's the law. It's the plaintiff's attorney saying, here's what we want. If you're going to settle your case with us, here's what we want in the settlement agreement. And I'll start with the Anthem case. One of the requirements in the settlement agreement is that the plan committee has to hire an independent consultant, and they have to look at all the share classes of all the mutual funds in their plan and consider which is the lowest cost to the plan, the available share classes. But then they go beyond that. They say, and you also have to look at collective trusts that are similar to the mutual funds available to your plan, a similar investment style, investment management, investment results, and that's separately managed accounts if your plan's big enough to have that available to you. So the litigation, which started off with, wow, that's an expensive mutual fund, then it moved to, do you have the right share class? It's now moving to, have you considered collective trusts and separately managed accounts if they're available to your plan, because of plan size mainly. In any event, you should be aware that we're now evolving into the next iteration, and that the key is for plan committees to consider all of that. It's not that they have to decide on one or the other. It's did they go through a process where they considered it and made a thoughtful decision. It's incumbent on advisors to educate plan sponsors on that, incumbent on advisors to provide committees with the information needed to make the decision, and then it's incumbent on plan committees as fiduciaries to go through a thoughtful process in evaluating that information. Now, that probably doesn't surprise you too much, because I think if you were looking out to the future, you could almost see that coming. The next one's a little more interesting, and the fact that you may not have seen it coming. The plaintiff's attorneys, and when I say plaintiff's attorneys, I'm really talking about the Schlichter law firm in the cases that we're talking about today, because they're adding all these conditions to their settlement agreements. They're insisting that the plan committees go out on a request for proposal for the plan record keeper, and that the record keeper quote the record keeping cost as a per participant cost, for example, $35 a participant, $50 a participant, rather than as a flat dollar amount, and certainly rather than as a percent of assets. Now, when I said get a quote from the record keeper on a per participant basis, that doesn't mean that it has to be charged to the participant on a per participant basis. It's just how the cost of the record keeping is determined. The law doesn't say anything about any of that. It doesn't talk about percent of assets. It doesn't talk about flat dollar amount. It doesn't talk about per participant. So the law is a little different than what the plaintiff's attorneys are asking for. What the law says is it has to be reasonable for the services rendered. And that in litigation will be where the rubber hits the road. Sandy and I were talking about the fact that this came up in the NYU case. And Sandy, do you want to say something about that?
Well, the argument that the Schlichter firm is addressing here was the same argument, I think, that they raised in the NYU case, which is the theory of the case was that the expense would be less on a participant basis than it would be either as a percentage of fees or as a general flat fee to the plan. And that was rejected by Jess Forrest as being the ideal fee base. So I know that they're trying to extract the language in their settlement agreements, but I don't know necessarily that it's supported by case law. I think that they just, people are anxious to get out of these litigations and they're willing to make some compromises.
Yeah, I think, what in effect, if you read the NYU opinion, the judge got a little bit confused between how the charge is calculated versus how it's allocated to participants. So the opinion itself, the wording is a little goofy, but in the final analysis, the judge said you don't have to have your record keeping on a per participant basis. And that's consistent with what I said the general rule was, which is it's got to be reasonable. It doesn't matter how it gets calculated. You could calculate it by the number of angels that dance on the head of a pin, but if it's reasonable, there aren't any damages, because that's all the law requires. It has to be a reasonable amount. The BB&T case, by the way, which also settled with the Schlichter firm, said the same thing about lowest cost share classes, collective trust, and separately managed accounts. So that is repeating itself. But my favorite part of the BB&T settlement, though, was the part that said that the plan committee had to hire an experienced ERISA attorney to provide fiduciary training to the plan committee. I think I should turn in a bit on that one. Anyway, moving on to the Vanderbilt case. Vanderbilt has a couple of interesting issues. First, it's a 403B plan. So it's a private sector, a private university, but a private sector 403B plan. So it's the first major settlement with conditions, $14.5 million settlement. These are all BB&T was a $24 million settlement. They're all big numbers. But when you get to the conditions of the settlement agreement, the Vanderbilt 403B case, the plaintiff's attorneys insisted, and Vanderbilt agreed, that they would have a provision in their record-keeping agreement that contractually prohibited the record-keeper from using participant information for non-planned sales, for marketing and sales to the participants outside of the plan, unless the participants explicitly agreed. And their position is that that information, the data about participants, belongs to the participants and not to the record keeper. The record keeper is just given it to administer the plan. Now, that issue came up in another case, the Northwestern University case, and the judge ruled for Northwestern University, holding that participant data was protected by the privacy laws, but was not a plan asset that had to be administered by the plan fiduciaries. Schlichter has since said that there will be more litigation on this in the future. So what do people need to do? I think that advisors need to be aware of this, and they need to talk to their plan committees as a part of their fiduciary training about the Vanderbilt settlement and about the Northwestern University case. But this is a legal issue. It's not an investment or even a plan issue in a sense. It is a pure legal issue. So I would recommend that advisors suggest to plan committees two things. One, that their attorney advise them on what they should be doing about this. And two, that the plan committee have somebody from the record keeper come to the next meeting and explain how they use participant data to sell them other products and services, because plan committees have to decide whether or not they want that done vis-a-vis their participants. And that if they do, if it is okay, if they do feel that those additional products and services are valuable, and their attorney says, yeah, we don't see an issue with this, we agree with the Northwestern University decision, then they can proceed on that basis, perhaps with a specific provision in the record-keeping agreement about what can be done with participant data so that everybody's on the same page. That's a quick view at some of the issues I thought were pretty interesting in those settlements, and with my advice on what you should do about it. In the interest of time, well, I want to segue over to Brad to talk to us about the SECURE Act. It's got a number of really interesting provisions for retirement plans, but also seems to be in a bit of a quagmire in the Senate after overwhelmingly being passed by the House. Brad?
Well, thanks, Fred. And yeah, it really is one of this has been the fate so far of the SECURE Act has been one of the more interesting features of this Congress. On the one hand, you had the newly elected Democrat-controlled Congress operating in at least this one area in a highly bipartisan fashion, where the Republicans and the Democrats and the committee had worked together for several years, came together with a final bill with about 29 provisions that make a variety of useful changes for qualified plans, for IRAs, for retirement savings in general, and actually passed it by a unanimous vote in the committee, got it to the House floor, passed it 417-3 in the House, and it's really hard to overstate how rare it is for Congress to get that type of unanimity on substantive provisions. And then it went to the Senate, and the problem in the Senate boiled down to time. If the Senate wanted to come up with a competing bill that would take the provisions of the RESA legislation, of the new Portman-Cardin legislation, of other bills introduced by other senators, do a bill in the Finance Committee, it would have to do all that, report that bill, send it to the Senate floor, have the Senate floor consider it, go through all the amendment processes there, deal with the filibuster and all the fun things that go with legislation in the Senate, send a final bill out of the Senate, which would then be different than the House bill, which would require a conference committee between the House and Senate and appointed members of both chambers to get together and write a new bill, which would then go back to the House and then to the Senate, to then to the President. Obviously, that is a long period, so the other option was for the Senate to just pass the House bill without amending it. The problem is that there were some last-minute changes made in the House, particularly dealing with what you could use 529 plans for and whether they could be used for homeschool expenses. Several other objections as well have emerged in the Senate. such that they can't just pass the House bill without getting all 100 senators to agree. And unfortunately, that is a very rare occurrence. So there's some holds placed on the bill. There have been some objections to the bill, and those have not yet been worked out. So a bill that maybe I shouldn't have gone out on a limb and made a prediction that I think on our last call I said it was about 90% chance it would pass. It's now looking a lot worse. It's looking more like maybe 20 or 30 or 40%, because ultimately it doesn't look like it's going to get through the Senate as a standalone bill, but rather would need to be folded into some big overarching omnibus legislation or something of that nature. And the first opportunity for that just happened this week, and it was not included. So the fate of this bill is still in limbo. And I won't go through all the provisions, but there's some fairly important ones here. One is pooled employer plans, which is the open MEP concept that we've talked about for a number of years that would allow unrelated small businesses to join together in one plan with one $5,500 and one audit, which would reduce some of the burdens for those businesses in offering a 401k plan. That's a very popular provision. It would do a couple of things on annuities. It would offer a safe harbor for the selection of an annuity provider by a plan, making it easier for plans to look at adopting annuities as a payout option for plans. It would require annually that there be a lifetime income projection for each participant based on what they've saved, which would let them see whether they're on the right track or not. It increased the safe harbor cap for automatic enrollment from 10% up to 15%, got rid of age limits for IRA contributions, moves the RMD age from 70 and a half back to 72. There's just a whole bunch of useful provisions in here that as a substantive matter should get through. One I should mention that's taken some criticism recently is that it effectively does away with stretch IRAs. If you have an inherited IRA, you'd have to take the distributions over 10 years instead of continuing to draw those out. So that is an area that's getting some criticism, but I think most of the groups who are interested in retirement plans have looked at this and said, okay, that's not a provision we love, but it's a provision we'd take to get some of these other real benefits. And it was included predominantly because of the pay-for issues. The revenue that raises offsets some of the revenue that's lost from these other changes. So you wrap it up. It's a bill that I think everybody likes, but which is being slowed down for reasons unrelated to actual retirement policy. And that, in a nutshell, is a quick civics lesson on Congress.
Well, Brad, thank you very much. Thanks for a good substantive report as well as a little bit of man bites dog. Brad, I think that is where it is. I think there are good provisions in there. They'd be helpful, but we don't know what's going to happen. And until the fog lifts a little bit on that, I don't see any reason to go any further. So let's segue over into a quick update on what's going on with the state fiduciary and best interest rules. But before I get to you, Brad, let me mention two things, or one thing, but in two contexts. We have a blog called the Broker Dealer Law Blog. One word, brokerdealerlawblog.com. And this, we post, whenever we update our state chart of fiduciary and best interest rules, which is approximately once a month, but it's really more event-driven, we will post it, and it'll go out to everybody subscribed to the blog. So if you want to get information on a regular basis about the most current developments on state fiduciary and best interest rules, subscribe to the blog. You'll get it automatically. Also, at the beginning, I think Jim or Sandy or both mentioned that we're going to be posting regular articles about Reg BI and the RIA interpretation and the other SEC guidance. They're going to be issuing some facts, the SEC is, to explain some of it based on questions they get from the public. We'll post information about that too. So, and it's all on the same blog. It's Broker Dealer Law Blog, one word, .com. And if you go and subscribe, you'll get all the stuff that we've talked about today. By the way, don't be misled by the Broker Dealer Law Blog. We're also doing RIA stuff. It's somewhat broader than the title. Anyway, Brad, long introduction. Now over to you. What about state fiduciary and best interest rules?
Yeah, well, the short answer is that a number of the states are really on a collision course with where the federal law is going. And it's going to set up some very difficult debates and probably litigation if it continues. You all probably remember that the state of Massachusetts, or excuse me, the state of Nevada sort of got out of the gate first, passing a law that would establish a uniform fiduciary standard. Their proposed regulation, which came out earlier this year, was very controversial because it really made some radical changes, things like just showing an analysis of a security to a client, whether or not you recommended it, was itself a fiduciary act. So there was an extensive amount of comments and controversy in Nevada. They have been considering those comments for several months, and we've not heard anything new from them about what their next step might be in terms of modifying the proposal, holding a required public hearing, et cetera. So that seems to be in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment. New Jersey is in the process of proposing a fiduciary standard as well. They had extended the comment period to accommodate the release of regulation best interest and form CRS by the SEC so that they could get some comments on exactly how those would interact. Actually, last week there was a hearing in Newark, New Jersey at the Bureau of Securities at which I testified on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce talking about the effects of that proposal. And Massachusetts has issued a very similar proposal to New Jersey to establish a fiduciary standard. And the comment period on the Massachusetts proposal, their preliminary solicitation of comments ends tomorrow. So those of you working on Massachusetts comments, you've got a deadline of tomorrow to get those in. Both New Jersey and Massachusetts would establish a uniform fiduciary standard. They would both put in place some rather troubling, in my view, restrictions that would have a pretty negative effect on the availability of transaction-based compensation. So, for example, in both regulations, to receive a transaction-based compensation, you'd have to show that the recommendation of a security is the best of the reasonably available alternatives, and the recommendation of the transaction-based compensation is the best of the reasonably available fee options. My big concern there is that best is not a fiduciary concept. In my view, it's the opposite of a fiduciary concept. You are a fiduciary, whether it's the Uniform Prudent Investors Act, ERISA, RIA, securities law under the 40 Act. In any of those cases, it's about procedural prudence, the process by which you make a decision, not the outcome of that decision. So as a legal standard, I don't think the best decision, which implies there's only one right answer, works. Secondly, in the real world, I think it would be almost impossible to say that this security is the best of all available securities. So there are some real issues with the actual text, which are being expressed in comments to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the state of New Jersey. And we'll see what their next steps are. And we're all waiting to see. One of the big issues there also is to what extent are these rules preempted by federal law? Does the National Security Markets Improvement Act on the securities side preempt these state efforts or not? Does ERISA preempt them, depending on how the states have written them? There's going to be a lot of debate about that if these go forward, because the argument is it's creating a conflicting patchwork of state laws that will make it very difficult to operate in multiple jurisdictions and consistent with federal law. Slightly differently, the state of New York, on August 1st, here coming up in a week, begins to its regulation best interest applicable to annuity transactions takes effect. So August 1st, if you're selling annuities to people in New York, residents of New York, you have to comply with their new best interest standard, which has about a 13-point checklist of items that must be considered in developing that recommendation. The New York best interest law takes effect for life insurance transactions February 1 of next year. So that's all proceeding along a path there in New York, and there's been a lot of work being done on compliance and getting ready for those rules. So New York is finished. It's a best interest standard. It's an insurance law. New Jersey, Massachusetts, Nevada are proposals. They're securities rules, not insurance rules, and they're still up in the air. But there's a lot of activity going on, and we anticipate other states, for example, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in New York State Legislature has indicated he wants to pursue a fiduciary rule in New York. There's just a lot of activity in the states related to fiduciary and best interest standards. And as I said, it's setting up a recipe for conflict with federal law, and we're likely to hear a great deal more about this as we go forward.
Yeah, two quick comments on that, Brad. One, there is some overlap between securities and insurance. For example, variable annuities and variable life are securities products, but they're subject to the New York insurance regulation. Vice versa, they're securities products, so they're also subject to the potential Nevada rule. So it generally speaking, they fall into pretty nifty separate silos, but in some cases there's overlap. So keep that in mind. If you're for example, a representative of a broker-dealer in New York or selling to somebody in New York, if you sell a variable annuity, even though you may think of that as a security, it will be on August 1st subject to the New York law. The second is there's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners is working on a uniform rule. Some states, including California, have come out and said, we want a rule similar to the New York rule for insurance. We don't want a suitability standard. We don't even want an enhanced suitability standard. We want something that looks fiduciary-like. So there's more to come on the insurance side as well.
Yeah, the NAIC's effort right now is to replace their old suitability rule for annuities with what they're calling the best interest rule for annuities. And while that's parallel to what New York has done, I think there are likely to be some differences, but that's an ongoing debate they're having. And it's also a great point about the overlap on variable life insurance and annuity products. It's important to note that in New Jersey, by statute, those products are not considered securities, even though they are considered securities for federal law and are considered securities in some other states. Massachusetts has a similar prohibition, and so, again, the point is this indicates how state-by-state specific this could get, and in turn, therefore, how compliance issues are going to be a challenge depending on what happens in the next year or two.
Yeah, it sounds like a mess. Well, Brad, we've finished the formal part of the presentation. The only thing I would add to that part is a day or two ago, you all got the confirmation from us of this program today. Attached to that was the state fiduciary best interest chart. So if you want to get the most recent version of it right now, it's there. You have it in your inbox. Brad, let me turn to some of the questions and answers. There's that one question was about that proposed legislation, I think, in the House to defund the SEC from enforcing Reg BI. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was very interesting. So the SEC promulgates the final rules on regulation best interest. Chair Waters of the Financial Services Committee in the House has argued that the SEC's actions are, in her view, insufficient. And she led the charge to amend the appropriations measure to prevent any of the SEC's funds from being used to implement regulation best interest. It appears that amendment, while it passed the House, is not going to go anywhere in the Senate. So in all likelihood, although, it's never done with appropriations bills until it's done, but in all likelihood, we don't think the SEC is going to actually be hindered in enforcing it, even though that is obviously a it passed the House. It was led by the chair of the Financial Services Committee, so it's a credible issue. It's a credible threat, but we doubt that that's going to happen in the final analysis.
What I've heard, too, is that the odds of that getting through the Senate are nil. Do you agree?
I think that's generally true, although, again, if they get to one of these big end-of-the-year omnibus bills, they got to cut deals left, right, and sideways. Again, never say it's over until it's actually done, but I think it's unlikely, very unlikely, that the SEC will be restricted from implementing Reg Best Interest.
Okay. Brad, we got several questions about the SECURE Act. You've answered some of them already, but let me just ask you for your take on a couple of things. One is, if it does get through and if the safe harbor for a plan committee selecting guaranteed lifetime income products for their plan is in the legislation and becomes effective, Do you think that that will, do you think that it will actually lead to people adding guaranteed lifetime income to their plans, at least as a distribution option or even as an accumulation option?
I think it's one of the factors that has prevented some of those options being more available. So I think that could well be. You know, one of the questions essentially plan sponsors have to ask themselves is, what if I pick an annuity provider and they go belly up 2 years from now or 6 years from now or 10 years from now? You know, this is an obligation that could go on 40 years. What's my risk? And so this would allow you to quantify and sort of cut off that risk. So that has to be a helpful factor. Other factors are going to go, though, to whether there's a desire for those participants to have that type of option. But I think there definitely is interest among plans in having some annuitized options more readily available. And this provision, I think, would help that.
Okay, one last question, and then we'll let you go, Brad. What do you know about the Cal Savers plan? And where we are on it, what's going on, what it'll look like, any ideas on that, up to and including whether or not, go ahead.
Yeah, so California and Illinois and Oregon and Washington are states that are pretty far down this road, are already implementing these concepts. And what it boils down to, obviously there's some differences in each one, but the basic concept is if an employer doesn't offer a retirement plan in the workplace, we, the state, California, Illinois, whomever, are going to mandate that that employer offer a payroll deduction IRA set up through our state program and default those participants into it, typically at a 3% contribution. So those programs have been implemented and are being phased in based on the size of the employer. So the largest employers are going first, then you know it's coming down market to smaller employers. And typically these programs have a cutoff for very small employers who don't have to participate. The concept is the best way to save for retirement is through payroll deductions. After all, the IRS gets paid that way, and there's a reason. So let's make that more widely available as a way to get people access to retirement savings opportunities. I do have several concerns about how these programs are going to work. It results in the state picking the investments, the default investments. It results in the state picking investment managers. There's just a lot of direct state activity in a marketplace that's going to grow to be very large amounts of money fairly quickly. I mean, if you take the entirety of California and look at all of the participants there, or eligible employees or employees that don't have access to retirement plans, and some significant fraction of them start contributing to IRAs, it's going to be a vast amount of money. And it's really making the state a market participant in this space where it hasn't been before. That's one set of issues. You know, how will that process work? What are the forms of redress if, you know, I'm having problems as a participant? But it also raises some questions about, is this going to effectively cannibalize small plan formation? If I'm a small employer and I'm thinking about a 401k, which is of course better than an IRA in terms of the opportunities it would provide to those participants, am I going to not adopt a 401k simply because I have this state-mandated program to fall back on? And I think that's a serious public policy concern. Are we actually inhibiting better options by virtue of providing some option? And so there's some real balances there. The upshot is we're likely to see this type of program spread. Many states are growing interested in this and having debates about it. So this is an emerging trend in our industry that I think is going to raise some pretty significant questions.
Well, Brad, thank you very much. I'll turn the spotlight off of you now and flip it over to Jim. Jim Lundy, somebody pre-submitted a question that says, as a broker-dealer, we have a related but separate RIA. We have some financial professionals that are broker-dealer only and others that are RIA only, but the vast majority are dual-hatted, meaning they have both registrations. Under Reg CRS, how many forms of the document will we need? So, Jim, jump right in.
Sure. And based on that question, Fred, I think the answer is all of them. And at the firm level, it's all of them. But the point at which whether a particular form applies to a particular relationship is at the initial point of contact for the relationship. So for the standalone investment advisory reps, they all need to form CRS for RIAs. For the standalone broker-dealer reps, they will need a form for the standalone broker-dealer requirements. For the dually hatted reps, they will need to either produce both forms or the collective four-page form. So I think that answers that, Fred. You know, the one thing I think that may need some additional internal inquiry is what does it mean to have a standalone but related? The RIA is either an affiliate or it is not under the securities laws. So I think that depends ultimately on what the facts are regarding that relationship. If it is a truly standalone that may have a corporate relationship but not a true affiliated registration relationship, then perhaps the standalone RIAs with that entity may be subject to a form CRS obligation for that entity. But again, that depends on the relationship, because if it is affiliated under the federal securities laws, then that form is required for that particular firm.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting to me about what the SEC has said here is that if they're completely unrelated RIAs and broker-dealers, for example, think of somebody who has their own little RIA firm, but they're also a registered rep of a broker-dealer. Come June 30 of next year, that individual, even though the entities are unrelated, that individual will have to deliver both CRSs, because there won't be a four-page combined CRS because the organizations aren't affiliated. There will be a two-page RIA CRS and a two-page broker-dealer CRS, and both have to be delivered at the beginning, and the individual has to look at the account types offered by the broker-dealer and the account types offered by the RIA and recommend one that's in the best interest of the investor, whatever the heck best interest means. Now, keep in mind, this is just, the CRS is just for retail investors, individuals. So, for example, it would not apply to retirement plans, but participants are considered individual investors. So both would have to be given to a participant when, for example, talking to them about making a rollover to an IRA. These rules are more complicated than I think most people think. You really need to start paying attention to them now.
Fred, can I jump in and add one point? Because you raised a really good point about who, in fact, is the client. So when you're talking about that RIA, unaffiliated broker-dealer relationship, you know, one thing to be clear about is for broker-dealers providing clearing and custody services, their client is, in fact, the RIA firm, which is the institution. So, again, the devil gets into the details about these relationships and who, in fact, is the client, because, as you just said, Fred, there's a layer of complexity behind these requirements for what they strive to be simplistic disclosures in two or four pages. But as Sandy said earlier, if they were going to be simplistic, it wouldn't have taken, you know, over 500 pages to describe the nuances that are going to be at play here when this ultimately becomes effective.
I just prepared PowerPoints on the CRS, Jim. I think there are 40 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the overview. I mean, that doesn't get into all the whys and the little itty bitty details. That's amazing. Hey, operator Cody, we have time for a couple questions. Let's open it up.
Absolutely. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your line will indicate once your line has been opened. Once again, that is *1 if you'd like to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. Once again, that is *1 if you'd like to ask a question.
I have one more pre-submitted question. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Cody.
Thank you. Sorry about that, sir. We'll take our first question from Keith Mancini. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, this is probably for Brad. I haven't heard much on this, but I wanted to make sure people, you know, are aware. But, you know, the NAIC work with their revised annuity suitability standard, you know, the current active draft on that came out in November has a significant carveback of the retirement plan exemption. that is actually in place in New York. So I just wanted to point that out. That's an additional layer of complexity that could exist on the insurance side if the NAIC model goes through as is.
Yeah, I've looked at the various state proposals also, and in some cases it's pretty clear that ERISA plans are carved out from the rules because of the feeling that the Department of Labor and ERISA cover that. But in no case of any of them I've looked at so far is it clear that participants are carved out. So when a rollover recommendation, for example, is made to a participant, is that advice to the plan or is that advice not advice to a plan? My suspicion is it's not, but the rules have not been very clear on that. But thank you very much.
Thank you. We have another question,
Cody,
in the queue.
Sure.
Caller, please go ahead.
Hello.
It is now open.
Hi. You guys discussed the new rules surrounding utilizing participant information in order to market additional sales to participants. Do the same rules apply in normal interactions that an advisor or broker would have with participants? So if it's not data being utilized purposefully, but other services are being sold during the interaction or getting new to employees, what are the nuances or complexities therein?
Yeah, going back to what Sandy said about, or what I said rather about the Northwestern case, the only law on the subject is that that the record keepers can use the information. The Vanderbilt case was a settlement between the defense attorneys and the plaintiff's attorneys and their clients. So we don't really know a whole lot about where this is going or how far it extends. I'm doing a lot of work for clients right now on the California Consumer Privacy Act, and other states are going to be adopting similar rules. So anybody who collects information about individuals is going to be a lot more regulated in the future, but that's in the future. We're still working on how these rules are going to work. For the moment, I would just say that to the extent that you're working with a plan sponsor and you're providing additional services to participants and you're somehow predicating those services or on information that you've gathered about the participants through the plan, I would make sure that it's okay with the plan committee for you to be doing that. Going forward, though, I think all investment advisors and broker-dealers need to really be paying attention to the developments and the privacy laws. And I can't really say what they are because they're in the state of development. But right now, within the United States, the one that's the most aggressive is the California Consumer Privacy Act, which becomes applicable on January 1 of next year, but will not be enforceable until sometime towards the end of next year. But you'll be getting more on that in the future. I'm sure we'll be talking about that at some point. So,
thank you.
Sorry, I couldn't give you a more definitive answer. So one more if somebody on the line.
Currently there are no further questions in the queue. Everyone, once again, that's star one.
Okay, somebody's pre-submitted a question that I accidentally overlooked, but it's how does Reg BI apply to commission compensation? Under Reg BI, commission compensation is certainly acceptable. The main rule, I mean, you got to get past disclosure and the other rules, but the main rule that's going to impact commission compensation is that broker-dealers will have an obligation beginning June 30 of next year to mitigate the financial incentives to the individual advisors, the registered representatives. Different broker-dealers could make different decisions about how to mitigate. Mitigate basically means to dampen down the effect of the financial incentive to the point that it would not reasonably affect the advice given by the financial advisor. But that's the whole definition. So broker-dealers, through supervision, through training, through product selection, through a whole host of reasons, processes that are used to select investments, are going to have to figure out how to dampen down variable annuities. How do you take the incentive effect? Well, you could have the same commission structure for all variable annuities. Mutual funds, same thing. But there will be a requirement of mitigation, and different broker-dealers will be making different decisions about mitigation. So that, in effect, remains to be seen. The crystal ball on that one is foggy. Well, folks, we're out of time. We're out of questions. Jim Dolan, why don't you wrap this up?
Certainly, Fred. Thanks so much. And a special thanks to Brad, Sandy, and Jim for sharing their expertise with us. I think it was a great call today, and you know, we're excited about our next call, which will be in October on the 24th. So please mark your calendars. And again, thanks for joining us. It's been really helpful. Fred, thanks so much. Hope everyone has a great day.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for your participation.